Everybody sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin. That dates me, doesn't it? So, for some strange reason, I've set myself the task of rambling around the subject of the death of God and the hell of atheism. I can't quite remember how this happened. I was in Hungary with Siha Manas, my secretary, who's responsible for everything, just a couple of weeks ago, where we have some Dhamma Mitras, some Mitras from a Roma community, Gypsy community. And in the nature of things, they're in a lot of trouble at the moment. The very strong right-wing government, which is... fairly explicitly anti-Roma, and they're facing a huge amount of problem. Their finance has been cut, so we'd gone there to do a retreat and to discuss the Dhamma, but they were facing such a huge crisis that they didn't really have time for much of that, although we did our best to apply the Dhamma to the situation that they were in. So we found ourselves with quite a bit of time and talking quite a bit amongst ourselves. That's the two of us. And somehow or other, we must have talked about something that led to Siha Manas saying, "That's a really good title for your ramble at the LBC." But I can't completely remember what the background to it was. This is not a very good way to introduce an I deliberately didn't want to think too much because I wanted to give more time for questions from you lot. But I need to prime you so that I create some puzzlement in your minds and you have some questions to ask me. I'm sure I'll manage. Reflecting on how I could start, for some reason the image that came into my mind was my mother. It all goes back to her. She was a woman of very active and forceful character, as only a New Zealand woman can be. Where is she, Mikey? She hailed from New Zealand. And she'd led a very, very active and effective life. But she had a stroke 7 years before she finally died, and she was bedridden. And it was, of course, a really extremely frustrating and painful experience for her. Just not able to function in her accustomed way. She couldn't express herself. She couldn't. She could talk, but she couldn't sort of make things happen. Of course, she managed to make me do things, but that's another question. I found it very, very painful watching her, but also very, made me very reflective, because there's more than a little of my mother in me. I remember one day, she'd been particularly sort of irritable all day, she'd completely lucid all the way through. And she suddenly sort of burst out, "I'm fed up with being me. I'm fed up with being me." I knew exactly what she meant. She's not able to really do anything, not able to affect the world very strongly. You know, none of us would do exactly what she wanted. And even if we tried, we'd always get it slightly wrong. She couldn't really keep pace with what was going on in the larger world anymore. Although she was very lucid, she couldn't sort of take in information very easily. And she just stuck with me, just me. One, because I know this experience very, very well. You just find yourself going round in loops of really tedious thoughts and tedious wishes that sort of circle back on themselves and that there doesn't seem to be any escape from. Of course, most of the time you're just caught up in it, just cycling round and round, and no reference outside yourself, you know, because most of the time we don't experience this because we're able to affect the world around us, and there's an illusion of reference beyond ourselves. But in her case, that was not really possible. I've experienced this myself, especially in retreat. I'm sure I should be trying to sell to you all going on retreat, and I really do recommend it. But one of the experiences one can have on retreat is, well, it's just you. Yeah, there's somebody there ringing bells and chanting occasionally and giving talks and giving you instruction and so forth. But in the end, it's just you and your brain, your mind. It's especially the case on a solitary retreat. I did a 5-month solitary retreat 5 years ago, and it was an extremely positive experience on the whole, and a very, very powerful one. But a lot of it was really quite painful, because suddenly exposed is just me. The sort of circularity of me-ness. It's going round and round and round. Most of it's not bad. Some of it is. Those are the more interesting bits. But most of it's just boring. It's like a sort of cocktail party going on, eternally going on in your mind, with trivial conversations about minutiae, which really don't matter. Or long conversations, irritable conversations with people, you're getting irritable about things that they might say if you ever got to talk to them. Just going round and round and round, the circularity of I. Where do I go from here? Oh, yeah, well, this is the hell of atheism. That's my point. That the hell of atheism is you're just left with I. There's nothing beyond, there's nothing bigger, there's nothing more significant. Yes, there are values, but they're values that are in the scale of I. They all refer back to me, my values. And even great values, values that have an altruistic element to them, seem, if you are honest, circle back to I. It's not a bad thing, but if you become sufficiently aware of this circularity, it's intensely frustrating, boring, limited, and that is the hell of I, of atheism, or the hell of nihilism. The hell of I. You're just left with me now in this life until I die. And then curtains. And I started with this experience because I don't want to end up discussing grand cultural theory. You know, I've done my Nietzsche. And I'm not going to try to give you an account of Nietzsche's ideas of the death of God. It's from him that this phrase has become part of cultural currency. What precisely he meant by it, there are still many PhD theses to be written upon. Nobody's quite definitively clear. What he seemed to mean was not that God, in some, you know, was somebody who actually existed who is now dead, but what he meant, it seems, and this is no doubt an oversimplification, was that God as a defining factor in our cultural experience no longer worked. It wasn't real, wasn't alive. Of course, there are many people who are still Christians and theists and so forth, but for the culture as a whole, it, he said, was no longer the case. I remember that very much from my own experience. I was brought up as an Anglican in the days when we still had worshipped in God's own language, which was Elizabethan and Jacobean English. Mm-hmm. And the Book of Common Prayer and the King James Bible and the, of course, good Victorian hymns, ancient and modern. Sorry for the culturally illiterate who came from other religions in the great Anglican Church. it was, you know, for a while it sort of worked for me. But there was a certain point when I realised that I really had no idea who God was. And I went through confirmation. I won't bother to explain the technicalities of Anglican Christianity, but we had preparation for confirmation, and there was a priest who was preparing us. So he said, "Is there anything you need to know before you're confirmed?" So I said, "Well, please, can you explain who God is?" it seems to be a fairly fundamental question. Anyway, his answer was that he himself thought of God as a sort of frog spawn. I decided I'd inquire no further. It didn't seem to matter. I was still confirmed. I'm a communicating member of the Anglican Church to this day. No, I'm not. I'm getting at, it wasn't that I suddenly decided I don't believe in God. It just, I suddenly realised that the term had no reference for me. It didn't refer to any experience that I could identify. I loved the ceremonial. I loved the language of the Book of Common Prayer. I loved the hymns. I loved the organ music and so forth. But it had no reference to anything that I could identify. And that was the collapse of all of that for me, and I drifted away into. Well, I suppose a sort of a vague agnostic secularism. But I remember very strongly, particularly, God, I'm going into an autobiography, I didn't mean to do this, but I remember particularly through LSD, just sort of realising this hell of I, just left with I, this insistent, powerful consciousness which focused around me, didn't seem to go anywhere else. It just, every time it circled back. That's why I started to quest for something else, and why I'm here. But I think this is what Nietzsche was getting at. It was not that the culture, as it were, as a whole. That is Western European culture of the 19th century, 18th, 19th, 20th century, had sort of disproved God. It sort of run out of God. It just didn't sort of mean very much. Of course, there are other cultures where it does mean something to people, other cultures in this country where that means something to people. But for me and for Nietzsche in Western culture as a whole, at that time, it just sort of ran out. And the consequence, he declared, was an increasing nihilism. And interestingly enough, what he feared was passive nihilism, which was a nihilism in which we simply adjusted to the inherent emptiness of things, the absence of real meaning, and just sort of made things a bit comfortable until the lights went out. Interestingly enough, he'd referred to this as Western Buddhism. And I have some fear that this could be Western Buddhism. Buddhism in the West gets grafted on to the sort of nihilistic tendencies of occurrence in Western culture, which are increasingly worldwide, and that it sort of becomes a lukewarm, dilute, nice way of occupying the time until the lights go out. And there you go. We're all nice to each other, moderately, until it's all over. Of course, it's much better that we're nice to each other until it all ends than that we're nasty. Although Nietzsche wasn't completely convinced about that. He thought some railing against the dying of the light, rage, rage, rage against the dying of the light. Dylan Thomas, who of course was a Schopenhauerian, was better than going quietly. So yes, we've got this trend, a strong trend that affects many of us, not everybody here, I know, it affects many of us, and increasingly the zeitgeist, really there being no value beyond the individual existence, no value beyond the I, no value beyond self. And we try to arrange it as comfortably as we can, so that we get along reasonably well. And when other people from other cultures force themselves upon our attention, we try to make it comfortable with them too, if we have to. Fascinating watching all that playing out in here, in other cultures too. But it's pretty grim. It's what I call the mall experience, the shopping mall experience. And I used to, when I was looking after my mother, I used to take her in a wheelchair to a shopping mall to go, to that modern sacrament, shopping. And I'd find as I was in the shopping mall a sort of despair overwhelming me. And sometimes I felt dangerous. There was in me a vandal, that I'd quite like to smash a few windows. I was being squashed down by the shallowness of it all, the narrowness of it all, the hollowness of it all. A quite physical experience of being squeezed in. That is the hell of atheism, the hell of nihilism. It's a world in which is bounded only by self. At its best, it's bounded by self in interaction with other selves. At its very best, a self in interaction with other selves in a sort of positive way, a friendly way, even a metaphor way. And that's really good, really important. But for me, it's not enough. It leaves one with a terrible sense of the futility of it all. That you turn up, you put in your time, and then you check out. And that's it. And I'm not sure it's worth the bother, particularly as age goes on. That's the hell of atheism. It's a tangible experience of narrowed horizons in which the self is the only arbiter. Nobody lives entirely in that hell. For a human being, it's almost impossible to live entirely in that hell. But and we have senses of other values and so forth. But we don't have, many of us miss anything that supports, in a way that's acceptable to us, a sense of supervenient values, values that go beyond self. Nietzsche's argument was that the European Enlightenment, the gradual development of reason and empirical inquiry, made us finally realise that we'd run out of God, or God had run out on us. He argued that our increasing technical competence, our ability to manipulate the world, our ability to discover more and more about the world through rational scientific inquiry, finally sort of squeezed out God. And of course, since his time, that process has gone so much further. Our ability to control and manipulate the world around us has increased hugely, even in my relatively short lifetime. And I'm getting to that age where I start to tell people, you don't know what it was like when I was young. I remember still having to lift the receiver and ask the operator to put you through to anything outside your own area. And I'm not that old. Oh, all right, I am. But my pension in 3 weeks' time. There's huge change in this ability to manipulate, control, understand the world around us as the whole Enlightenment enterprise has gathered pace. You know, you're way back in the early 17th century, Francis Bacon had that sort of vision of a scientific inquiry which would sort of produce an encyclopedia of all knowledge. Oh, we've got the machinery for it now, where all of us can have access to it. And it really leaves less and less room for wonder, less and less room for mystery, or at least apparently does. So I believe that this hell of atheism, hell of nihilism is perhaps a better word, hell of a limited self is more and more urgent than ever. But I don't believe that the solution lies in trying to resuscitate God. I believe that his pulse really has stopped irredeemably, that irreversible brain damage has taken place, and even the kiss of life would not work. God really is dead. It's just not for the great majority, it's no longer something that can become a culturally sustaining force. Individuals can be sustained by it. It can't be a culturally sustaining force. That's my supposition, and Nietzsche's too. Good authority. But it's almost unbearable what we've arrived at. A highly commercialized, self-centered, very efficient, but very limited life in which entertainment is delivered to us with frightening sort of ease so that we relate to it increasingly superficially and so on. Oh, you know the complaints. You've probably read your op-ed articles in the press, or if whatever it is, op-ed blogs. For me, this is why I'm a Buddhist. This is why I'm part of a Buddhist order. The answer doesn't lie in a resuscitation of eternal verities. It doesn't lie in trying to resurrect metaphysical entities that have ceased to have any potency, any cogency. It certainly doesn't lie in remaining where we are. We have to find a new way of living values that go beyond ourselves, and a way that fits into the very real advances that the European Enlightenment and everything that's followed on from it has given, particularly in terms of the amelioration of the environment. It has to be something that's in tune with that, with empirical inquiry, with observation, with reason, with the critical appraisal of large philosophical concepts, and the recognition that those large philosophical concepts can never be related to any experiential reality. Leaping over vast topics in a few sentences and hoping nobody notices. Buddhism offers itself as a middle way. In the Buddha's first teaching, after he had gained enlightenment at Bodh Gaya, you remember he walked to Shravasti, and he encountered his old companions in asceticism, and he taught them a middle way. a middle way between eternalism and nihilism. Eternalism is that belief in God, if you like. God is the epitome of eternity, eternalism. A metaphysical entity that has ontological reality, that really exists independently of us, but which in some mysterious way we can never directly know, and of which we are the subjects, so to speak. So eternalism is the belief that there is in reality an eternal entity, to put it that way, God, whether you think of God in personal terms or in terms of principle, but which is the real meaning of our lives. Nihilism, at the other extreme, is the belief that life is simply bounded by birth and death, that it's some sort of accident which has no real significance beyond itself. Both these extremes were known at the time of the Buddha. There were people who very strongly asserted divine reality of one kind or another in many, many different terms, as there are still in India today. There are also many people who believed that there was no such ultimate reality, no divine reality, that life had no ultimate meaning, who were nihilists. Very interesting, the whole spectrum that was there in India at that time. And the Buddha said that both of these ideas, both of these beliefs, well, they are ideas. They don't find their reference in reality. You cannot observe them. They're ideas that are added on to reality. Very interestingly, he said that eternalism is the overdwelling on things coming into being. So, you know, like this event has come into being. You know, I came here, and all of you came here. And a long time ago, this fire station was built by some good Victorians, and converted and so forth. All of these things have arisen. So that this situation arises. Everything happens like that. It comes into being. Of course, it also passes away, you'll be relieved to hear. Sometime around 7 o'clock, it will pass away. And we'll all go off into something else. So, according to the Buddha, everything arises and passes away. And that arising and passing away is the reality of things. But what happens is that we seize either upon the arising phase or upon the ceasing phase. So that you either sort of eternally optimistic and dwell upon the fact that things are always coming into being. You know the sort of person. It'll always get better. I hope that enough of us optimists. So you're always dwelling on the fact that something happens, something comes about, something arises. So we absolutize our experience of things arising. But some people, and maybe some of you will have this experience, and no doubt everybody has this experience at times, you have the experience of dwelling on things fading, things passing away. You know, those moments of a depression, you know, particularly when you experience great loss or tragedy or failure, your mind becomes sort of fixated on things ending, on things passing away, things fading. And the Buddha said that what then happens is that you erect on the basis of that experience a sort of grand idea. You may not flesh it out in highly philosophical terms, but it's a sort of feeling idea about life. Life is like this. It ends. Things end. Or you you flesh out your experience of things arising in terms of things arise. Things are. They have solid, fixed, tangible reality. Do you see what I mean? So that you erect this from this flow, never-ending flow of coming into being, passing away, which are absolutely simultaneous. To arise is to pass away. Whilst something is arising, it's already passing away. While something's passing away, it's already arising. They're absolutely simultaneous aspects of the totality of our experience. But our minds work in simple ways. We're simple-minded creatures. If we weren't simple-minded creatures, we'd be completely overwhelmed by experience. Anybody read Borges, the great South American Argentinian writer, a wonderful writer, some strong Buddhist influence, actually. Very strange stories. Often he just sketches in a few pages just as the kind of germ of a story. He had one story called Funes the Memorious, which was about a gaucho who was riding along on his, whatever gauchos ride along, a horse. And, thank you. And fell off and hit his head on a stone. And the effect of falling and hitting his head on a stone was that from that moment on, all his experience was completely present to him at once. And so everything that he'd ever experienced was completely present to him at one and the same moment. And of course, that meant that he couldn't do anything, because all his experience was present to him in a single apprehension. How could he function? He couldn't get breakfast. We function by simplifying. We break up the impossible complexity. It's beyond complexity, because complexity itself is an idea. The impossible complex unity of things, we break it up into bite-sized munches, which make it intelligible to us. I, you. Now, then, today, tomorrow, over here, over there. We break it all up. And thank goodness, otherwise I would be dumb. You might have a different view of that, but we wouldn't be able to speak to each other, because our language itself uses these bite-sized munches that we make of our experience, these intelligible abstractions, these simplifications of the impossible complexity of things. We break it up so that it's manageable. And this is very, very useful. It means that we can leap on our prey and eat it. I don't know whether anybody does that anymore, but we can choose our mates. We can generally survive as animals. And then it's the whole basis for our civilization, that we're able to use ideas, we're able to express them in words, that enables us to operate together and to create the civilizations that we have. But they're all simplifications. They don't refer to reality, or they refer to reality, but without ever exhausting reality. So one of the most basic simplifications we make, according to the Buddha, is this idea of existence. And of course, if you have an idea of existence, you must have an idea of non-existence. So we posit a reality. Things exist. They come into being and they endure, they perdure. Some of us dwell on that perdurance. Some of us dwell on that passing away. Endurance, the dwelling upon the coming into being, when it's erected into a grand philosophical or religious idea, is the idea of ultimate truths, ultimate realities, ultimate ontological entities, God. when we dwell upon that ceasing, that fading, that passing away, we absolutize that in terms of an ultimate meaninglessness, nothingness, or the most common modern form of it is materialism. Simply that there's a play of atoms and molecules of which we are a sort of sophisticated byproduct. So these two, according to the Buddha, are the dominant sort of ideas at the back of our minds, and we'll tend to one extreme or the other, or some sort of oscillation between them. But neither of them, according to him, represent reality accurately, and neither of them really enable us to lead a fully satisfying and effective life. The problem of eternalism is that we suppress our experience and put it in make it secondary to an idea of something greater. And I remember this as a tiny Christian, you know, trying to suppress myself, and you know what I was trying to suppress. Fortunately, it escaped eventually. But you sort of subordinate your ordinary natural sort of emotions as a human being, as a human animal, you could say. You subordinate them to some grand idea, and you sort of try to force your life into the Procrustean bed of God or whatever. So the Buddha said that, well, while this can make you an easier person to be with, because at least you don't go around raping and pillaging, it doesn't make for happiness. And usually, you know, something escapes the cage that you put it in. On the other hand, he said that nihilism, the absolutizing of fading, leads you to believe nothing really matters. Nothing really means anything, so you can do whatever you like. It doesn't matter what you do, so long as you... Well, it doesn't really matter what you do, because sooner or later it's all going to end. So, basically, you then rape and pillage with abandon. Well, we're probably usually more moderate than that, constrained by social constraints, but not by any real ethics. So the Buddha said that these are false trails. They don't lead to a real solution. They lead to various kinds of oppression. In the case of eternalism, the oppression, internal oppression, the oppression of, as it were, part of yourself, to use that that metaphor, also the oppression of others, the oppression of others who are not the right people, who belong to the wrong group, who behave wrongly, don't do the right things, because they're not in tune with the eternal verity which you alone, well, you serve. So he argued, and very cogently, history doesn't take a lot of examination to prove him right. All sorts of unpleasantness comes from that kind of absolutizing. And nihilism is, if anything, worse, because the complete absence or relative absence of moral values, of course, leads to immoral behaviour and offensive and destructive behaviour. The Buddha said that neither of these really work as modes of personal satisfaction or as modes of our collective life. They all have their internal instability. He argued that the issue was much more empirical. What you could say, he said, was that the only thing we can really know is that whatever arises in dependence on conditions. Whatever we can, in our human experience, know comes about as a result of previous conditions. And on the basis of those conditions, it leads to further arisings. So that he argued that our approach needs to be empirical. We can observe patterns of conditioned arising. Those patterns of conditioned arising are not merely materialist. There are patterns of conditioned arising that govern our inner experience. Those of you who have been on previous rambles will have rambled around the niyamas with me. And this is what he's talking about. He's talking about the orderedness of things. That if we establish certain conditions, certain inner experiences unfold. And most cogently, for the purposes of my initial exposition, those inner conditions can lead to an experience that goes beyond mere self-centeredness, mere self-orientation. If we establish the right conditions empirically through the exercise of our wills, we build up certain conditions. And if we build up those conditions, things will arise within us. Our own inner experience will unfold in richer, more elastic, more pliable, more interactive ways. We'll find ourselves flowing more and more more freely with the world around us. In terms of human relationships, we'll find ourselves entering into stronger and stronger sense of empathy for others and a friendship with others. We'll find ourselves able to appreciate the value in life around us. We'll be able to appreciate meaning in art, in philosophy, and so forth. If we set up those conditions, we'll begin to reach beyond ourselves. And he said that in the end, those conditions, if we build them up with sufficient, what can I say? It's not even quite discipline, but a sufficient system, methodicalness, although that method has a certain creative spontaneity to it as well, a certain mystery to it. If we build them up, something will unfold within us, a set of experiences will unfold within us that do not circle back on I, and that we'll have an experience of something that happens in us, as it were, to us, but that we can't call mine. We can't at the same time call it anybody else's, because in a way what I and other people's arises within the context of a certain structure of mind. But when we go beyond that structure of mind, there's just experiences unfolding within us, experiences of consciousness free from I. I, if it's there, is just an element within consciousness. But one's identification, well, if you can speak of identification at all, as well, your identification has been dropped, and there is simply awareness. As some texts say, there's an experience of observing without any experience of an observer. There's just pure awareness, awareness without somebody being aware. And those arise quite naturally on the basis of conditioned processes that we can, from now, establish. So it's not a question of finding out what the ultimate eternal verities are and subordinating ourselves to them. Nor is it a question of recognising that life has no meaning and having as much fun as you're able to and as other people will let you. It's a question of building up quite consciously the conditions that will allow you to experience a somewhat freer state of mind, which will give you then the confidence to work further to build up a somewhat freer state of mind until ultimately, well, not ultimately, till the point comes when consciousness sort of breaks free of that limited notion of I. So, between the hell of theism and the hell of atheism lies the middle way. And the middle way is a process of dependently arising conditions out of which a state of mind may arise in which does not leave you trapped in I. So, I promised I'd leave some time for some questions, if such there be. Let's spend the last bit of time just seeing if there is anything that anybody wants to follow up. And then we'll see where we go tomorrow. So anything arising for anybody that needs... yeah.
At the risk of sounding like a bit of an idiot, you were saying, I can see that things kind of dying as they're born, but I can't quite see that things are being born when they're dying. I mean, like a tree, yeah, I can understand that, but me, I can't quite see that. When I die, I'm going to...
Right, yes, yeah, yeah. Yeah, well spotted. Not too much of an idiot. Not an idiot at all. Of course, has anybody seen the what's it called? The very, very good Italian film, Quattro... Quattro Volte, which is based on Pythagorean idea of four kinds of life. And it's a lovely film about the way in which, one thing passes into another. A very moving film, very Buddhist, if you like. Anyway, that clearly is the obviously observable within our material experience, within the mineral world and the vegetable world and the animal world. It's quite easy to see that molten lava turns into stone and stone gradually wears away and forms sand and so forth. That's quite easy to see that the death of the lava is the birth of the granite, and the death of the granite is the birth of the sand, and so on. It's easy to see within within the organic world, and even relatively easy, you could say, in the animal world that I live in a sheep field. I'm not literally in the sheep field, I'm surrounded by sheep. And you've seen sheep carcasses lying around, and they slowly rot away, and you can see them passing into something else. But yes, with your consciousness, less easy to see. Of course, in traditional Buddhism, Buddhism speaks against the background of the traditional Indian cultural belief in rebirth. So the perspective is that this consciousness, when it fades, provides the conditions for the arising of a new flow of conscious experience. Buddhism doesn't speak in terms of consciousness as a fixed thing. Consciousness is constantly changing. So that's what's meant there, that these conscious experiences that you're having now, according to classical Buddhist theory, which most Buddhists would believe, provides the basis in a new life for a new arising. So that what's happened to you in this life, to some extent will, or rather what's gone on in your mind in this life will, to some extent, condition what your mind is like in a new life. Just as what you did yesterday has a conditioning effect upon what you experience today. But of course that's, in a way, something that lies outside your immediate empirical experience. Is that?
Yeah.
No, I'm afraid, sorry. It would be nice to... And that, of course, raises horrible questions about whether this is a dogma or not. For me, it's not, partly because I have great faith in the Buddha, and that's what he taught. I have great faith in my teacher, and that's what he teaches. But also because of my own experience of what consciousness is, which I don't expect anybody else to believe.
I used to be a nihilist, an atheist, and so that made me feel rather empty and pessimistic.
Yes.
But that changed when I was about 19, and I had an experience of God. Ever since then, I've known that God is real.
Yeah.
And so ever since then, I've been an eternalist.
Right.
And I don't understand why people say that God isn't relevant. I mean, God is our creator.
Right.
He is our father. Which explains our identity. It's who we are.
Yeah.
He's our only hope after death and for eternity. And these issues are every bit as relevant today as they have ever been. Also, one other thing you mentioned, that people have problems with religion because they feel it's oppressive. But I think that's a misunderstanding. I find the only way, the only hope of fulfillment I have for all my desires is God, who is eternal. Love can be eternal. That's the only hope of fulfillment. So it's a mismanaging of religion or morality if we are oppressing ourselves. But I think we must ultimately either be nihilistic or eternalistic. Because aren't you, in describing this middle way, isn't it referring to eternal laws or eternal values or eternal consciousness?
Well, indeed, although, of course, there's an equivocation upon the meaning of the word eternal there. So that gravity, if you like, is an eternal principle, or rather an enduring principle. So long as there is a world that is made in the way that it is, gravity will be true. Heavy bodies will attract lighter ones. So that's a quite different sense of eternal than the sense of an eternal, an ontological eternal. And interestingly enough, what Nietzsche was talking about was what is sometimes called ontotheology, the idea of God as something existing independently as a being. To me, I wouldn't at all wish to deny your experience of what to you presented itself as God. For us as Buddhists, the issue is how you think about that. So I don't dispute your experience. What I would dispute is your theologizing of it, your way of thinking about it. So I would say, you know, from the Buddhist point of view, that you had a very valid experience, which undoubtedly is a really important one. But that when you fit it into a pre-existing dogmatic theoretical framework, you limit that idea, obviously we are going to differ on many of these subjects, but I at least can tell you what the Buddhist point of view is whilst respecting your point of view. The Buddhist point of view is that such experiences come, and they're real experiences. You can never say to somebody, you did not experience that, but what you make of that is something else. You know, to forgive me for going from the sublime to the ridiculous, but I might in some sort of perhaps psychotic state hear voices talking to me. Now, nobody can deny those voices. The issue is what one makes of those voices, how one interprets those voices. So Buddhism, the angle that Buddhism would take is to not interpret those experiences. It doesn't deny the experiences, but it seeks not to interpret them in metaphysical terms. So it would seek to leave the experiences as valid experiences. And I've experiences that I suspect are very similar to yours, of an overwhelming sense of love and of something that is beyond me, that gives life its meaning. But I'd not locate that in terms of God. I would simply leave the experience as an experience.
I was just going to ask you, when you were on retreat and you were talking about getting stuck with yourself, and I just wondered what you did at that stage.
Well, you see, I'd got nowhere to go, and although there were many sheep around me, their advice was not particularly helpful. Well, I just stuck with it. And in some ways, I think the experience of that the hell of nihilism, the hell of self, is an extremely valuable one. But you have to have some degree of confidence and discipline to stay with it, and to try to create the conditions that will take you further. Of course, if you're practicing within a tradition, practicing within a context such as ours, you'll have resources. So, for instance, for me, what I would do is reflect on the Buddha who went beyond that. So he embodies something beyond simply self-absorption. So through that, I'd make contact with that possibility. But I think it's very, very important to actually recognize the extent to which we are encircled in self. In some ways, it's sort of the beginning of it. Yes, please.
Can you clarify what the role of the Buddha is in this analysis? Because
in this analysis, yeah.
Is he a mere prophet like Muhammad or Moses? Or is he the God? Because he does seem to have God-like qualities.
Huh.
And there are lots of stories which seem to put him on that pedestal.
You're right, yeah.
So what is he?
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a famous saying, isn't it? What we love, we embellish. So if you look at Buddhist history, if you look at the texts, you can see that embellishment taking place. And it's very obvious that the Buddha of the earliest phases is very much a human being. But he's a human being who achieves a state which I've spoken of here as self-transcendent. He achieves a state of mind which is not bounded by self, and which he does not cast in terms of God. I think the answer is neither of the above. And it's very interesting, immediately after his enlightenment, he said to have met a wanderer who was extremely powerfully impressed by his appearance, because he just had this transcendent experience, and he's obviously glowing with it, something quite different about him. So in India, everybody always wants to know which box to put you in, usually the caste box, but you know, where do you belong here? Are you some sort of god? No. Are you some sort of demon? No. Okay, are you a human being? No. I'm a Buddha. I'm something new. I'm one who has, who knows, who has awakened from the sleep of self, if you see what I mean. So I think we have to try. Part of our trouble is that our English language and the predominant Western tradition has no sort of terms that really quite correspond to what the Buddha was. But yes, he was someone who began as a human being, through conditioned processes, matured his consciousness, matured his experience, so that it transcended self-clinging. Doesn't entirely satisfy you, but we'll more tomorrow. Ah, good. I'm very glad. Yeah. Confusion is what I want. Yeah.
Yes, you finished saying that conditioned horizon was what made up this middle way.
Ah.
Yes.
Mm.
Between this alternative between eternalism and nihilism.
Yeah.
And somehow at the beginning we're talking about Buddhism as a look in the West, as a lukewarm, softy way, alternative, where my ego met with your other egos and we try to do, to live a good life.
Right, right.
And I'm a bit troubled by that. Well, because I think that we are trying to do that middle way by meeting.
I think you misunderstood what I was saying. What I was saying is that I think there's that danger that modern Buddhism is assimilated to nihilism, the predominant nihilistic consumerism of our society. But that's certainly not what Buddhism is. That's what I was saying, that I think there's a danger that we interpret Buddhism in terms of that shallow nihilism. And I was referring to Nietzsche's own fear of the direction of Western culture. I think he misunderstood Buddhism profoundly. Yeah. So thank you for making sure we didn't fall into that danger, that I'm an advocate of a nice new nihilistic Buddhism. Mm-hmm. We probably should stop on that note.